The Short Story Hour, Volume 1. This comes to you courtesy of Miniature Masterpieces, who have an excellent range of quality short stories from the masters of the craft. Do search for Miniature Masterpieces at any digital store for further information. This hour opens with Rudyard Kipling's My Own True Ghost Story.
My Own True Ghost Story by Rudyard Kipling. As I came through the desert, thus it was, as I came through the desert, the city of dreadful night. Somewhere in the other world, where there are books and pictures and plays and shop windows to look at, and thousands of men who spend their lives in building up all four, lives a gentleman who writes real stories about the real insides of people. And his name is Mr. Walter Besant. But he will insist upon treating his ghosts, he has published half a workshop full of them, with levity. He makes his ghost seers talk familiarly, and in some cases flirt outrageously with the phantoms. You may treat anything from a viceroy to a vernacular paper with levity, but you must behave reverently towards a ghost, and particularly an Indian one. There are in this land ghosts who take the form of fat, cold, pobby corpses and hide in trees near the roadside till a traveller passes. Then they drop upon his neck and remain. There are also terrible ghosts of women who have died in childbed. These wander along the pathways at dusk or hide in the crops near a village and call seductively. But to answer their call is death in this world and the next. Their feet are turned backward, that all sober men may recognize them. There are ghosts of little children who have been thrown into wells. These haunt well curbs and the fringes of jungles, and wail under the stars, or catch women by the wrist and beg to be taken up and carried. These and the corpse ghosts, however, are only vernacular articles, and do not attack Saabs. No native ghost has yet been authentically reported to have frightened an Englishman. But many English ghosts have scared the life out of both white and black. Nearly every other station owns a ghost. There are said to be two at Simla, not counting the woman who blows the bellows at Syrie Dark Bungalow on the old road. Mysore has a house haunted of a very lively thing. A white lady is supposed to do night watchman round a house in Lahore. Dalhousie says that one of her houses repeats on autumn evenings all the incidents of a horrible horse and precipice accident. Murray has a merry ghost, and now that she has been swept by cholera, will have room for a sorrowful one. There are officers' quarters in Mianmir whose doors open without reason and whose furniture is guaranteed to creak not with the heat of June but with the weight of invisibles who come to lounge in the chairs. Peshawar possesses houses that none will willingly rent, and there is something, not fever, wrong with a big bungalow in Allahabad. The older provinces simply bristle with haunted houses, and march phantom armies along their main thoroughfares. Some of the dark bungalows on the Grand Trunk Road have handy little cemeteries in their compound, witnesses to the changes and chances of this mortal life in the days when men drove from Calcutta to the northwest. These bungalows are objectionable places to put up in. They are generally very old, always dirty, while the Khan Sama is as ancient as the bungalow. He either chatters senilely or falls into the long trances of age. In both moods he is useless. If you get angry with him, he refers to some Saab dead and buried these 30 years and says that when he was in that Saab service, not a Khan Sama in the province could touch him. Then he jabbers and mows and trembles and fidgets among the dishes, and you repent of your irritation. In these dark bungalows, ghosts are most likely to be found, and when found, they should be made a note of. Not long ago, it was my business to live in dark bungalows. I never inhabited the same house for 3 nights running, and grew to be learned in the breed. I lived in government-built ones with red brick walls and rail ceilings, an inventory of the furniture posted in every room, and an excited snake at the threshold to give welcome. I lived in converted ones, old houses officiating as dark bungalows, where nothing was in its proper place and there wasn't even a fowl for dinner. I lived in second-hand palaces, where the wind blew through openwork marble tracery just as uncomfortably as through a broken pane. I lived in dark bungalows where the last entry in the visitor's book was 15 months old, and where they slashed off the curry kid's head with a sword. It was my good luck to meet all sorts of men, from sober travelling missionaries and deserters flying from British regiments to drunken loafers who threw whiskey bottles at all who passed, and my still greater good fortune just to escape a maternity case. Seeing that a fair proportion of the tragedy of our lives out here acted itself in dark bungalows, I wondered that I had met no ghosts. A ghost that would voluntarily hang about a dark bungalow would be mad, of course, but so many men have died mad in dark bungalows that there must be a fair percentage of lunatic ghosts. In due time, I found my ghost, or ghosts, rather, for there were two of them. Up till that hour, I had sympathised with Mr. Besant's method of handling them, as shown in the strange case of Mr. Lucraft and other stories. I am now in the opposition. We will call the bungalow Katmal Dark Bungalow, but that was the smallest part of the horror. A man with a sensitive hide has no right to sleep in dark bungalows. He should marry. Katmal Dark Bungalow was old and rotten and unrepaired. The floor was of worn brick, the walls were filthy, and the windows were nearly black with grime. It stood on a bypath largely used by native sub-deputy assistants of all kinds, from finance to forests, but real Saabs were rare. The Khansamah, who was nearly bent double with old age, said so. When I arrived, there was a fitful, undecided rain on the face of the land, accompanied by a restless wind, and every gust made a noise like the rattling of dry bones in the stiff toddy palms outside. The Khansamah completely lost his head on my arrival. He had served a Saab once. Did I know that Saab? He gave me the name of a well-known man who has been buried for more than a quarter of a century, and showed me an ancient daguerreotype of that man in his prehistoric youth. I had seen a steel engraving of him at the head of a double volume of memoirs a month before, and I felt ancient beyond telling. The day shut in, and the Khansamah went to get me food. He did not go through the pretense of calling it Khana, man's victuals. He said Ratub, and that means, among other things, grub, dog's rations. There was no insult in his choice of the term. He had forgotten the other word, I suppose. While he was cutting up the dead bodies of animals, I settled myself down after exploring the dark bungalow. There were three rooms beside my own, which was a corner kennel, each giving into the other through dingy white doors fastened with long iron bars. The bungalow was a very solid one, but the partition walls of the rooms were almost jerry-built in their flimsiness. Every step or bang of a trunk echoed from my room down the other three, and every footfall came back tremulously from the far walls. For this reason, I shut the door. There were no lamps, only candles in long glass shades. An oil wick was set in the bathroom. For bleak, unadulterated misery, that dark bungalow was the worst of the many that I had ever set foot in. There was no fireplace, and the windows would not open, so a brazier of charcoal would have been useless. The rain and the wind splashed and gurgled and moaned round the house, and the toddy palms rattled and roared. Half a dozen jackals went through the compound singing, and a hyena stood afar off and mocked them. A hyena would convince a Sadducee of the resurrection of the dead, the worst sort of dead. Then came the ratub, a curious meal, half native and half English in composition, with the old Khansamah babbling behind my chair about dead and gone English people, and the wind-blown candles playing shadow bo-peep with the bed and the mosquito curtains. It was just the sort of dinner and evening to make a man think of every single one of his past sins, and of all the others that he intended to commit if he lived. Sleep, for several hundred reasons, was not easy. The lamp in the bathroom threw the most absurd shadows into the room, and the wind was beginning to talk nonsense. Just when the reasons were drowsy with blood-sucking, I heard the regular let-us-take-and-heave-him-over grunt of dooley-bearers in the compound. First one dooley came in, then a second, and then a third. I heard the doolies dumped on the ground, and the shutter in front of my door shook. "That's someone trying to come in," I said. But no one spoke, and I persuaded myself that it was the gusty wind. The shutter of the room next to mine was attacked, flung back, and the inner door opened. "That's some sub-deputy assistant," I said, "and he has brought his friends with him. Now they'll talk and spit and smoke for an hour." But there were no voices and no footsteps. No one was putting his luggage into the next room. The door shut, and I thanked Providence that I was to be left in peace. But I was curious to know where the Dooleys had gone. I got out of bed and looked into the darkness. There was never a sign of a Dooley. Just as I was getting into bed again, I heard in the next room the sound that no man in his senses can possibly mistake, the whirr of a billiard ball down the length of the slates when the striker is stringing for break. No other sound is like it. A minute afterwards, there was another whirr, and I got into bed. I was not frightened. Indeed, I was not. I was very curious to know what had become of the Dooleys. I jumped into bed for that reason. Next minute, I heard the double click of a cannon, and my hair sat up. It is a mistake to say that hair stands up. The skin of the head tightens, and you can feel a faint, prickly bristling all over the scalp. That is the hair sitting up. There was a whirr and a click, and both sounds could only have been made by one thing, a billiard ball. I argued the matter out at great length with myself, and the more I argued, the less probable it seemed that one bed, one table, and two chairs, all the furniture of the room next to mine, could so exactly duplicate the sounds of a game of billiards. After another cannon, a three-cushion one to judge by the whirr, I argued no more. I had found my ghost, and would have given worlds to escape from that dark bungalow. I listened, and with each listen the game grew clearer. There was whirr on whirr and click on click. Sometimes there was a double click and a whirr and another click. Beyond any sort of doubt, people were playing billiards in the next room. And the next room was not big enough to hold a billiard table. Between the pauses of the wind, I heard the game go forward, stroke after stroke. I tried to believe that I could not hear voices, but that attempt was a failure. Do you know what fear is? Not ordinary fear of insult, injury, or death, but abject, quivering dread of something that you cannot see. Fear that dries the inside of the mouth and half of the throat. Fear that makes you sweat on the palms of the hands and gulp in order to keep the uvula at work. This is a fine fear, a great cowardice, and must be felt to be appreciated. The very improbability of billiards in a dark bungalow proved the reality of the thing. No man, drunk or sober, could imagine a game at billiards or invent the spitting crack of a screw cannon. A severe course of dark bungalows has this disadvantage. It breeds infinite credulity. If a man said to a confirmed dark bungalow haunter, "There is a corpse in the next room, and there's a mad girl in the next but one, and the woman and man on that camel have just eloped from a place 60 miles away," the hearer would not disbelieve, because he would know that nothing is too wild, grotesque, or horrible to happen in a dark bungalow. This credulity, unfortunately, extends to ghosts. A rational person, fresh from his own house, would have turned on his side and slept. I did not. So surely as I was given up as a bad carcass by the scores of things in the bed because the bulk of my blood was in my heart, so surely did I hear every stroke of a long game at billiards played in the echoing room behind the iron-barred door. My dominant fear was that the players might want a marker. It was an absurd fear, because creatures who could play in the dark would be above such superfluities. I only know that that was my terror, and it was real. After a long, long while, the game stopped and the door banged. I slept because I was dead tired. Otherwise, I should have preferred to have kept awake. Not for everything in Asia would I have dropped the door bar and peered into the dark of the next room. When the morning came, I considered that I had done well and wisely, and inquired for the means of departure. "By the way, Khan Sama," I said, "what were those three Dooleys doing in my compound in the night?"
"There were no Dooleys," said the Khansama.
I went into the next room, and the daylight streamed through the open door. I was immensely brave. I would at that hour have played black pool with the owner of the big black pool down below. "Has this place always been a dark bungalow?" I asked.
"No," said the Khansama. 10 or 20 years ago, I have forgotten how long, it was a billiard room."
"How much?"
a billiard room for the Serbs who built the railway. I was Khansama then in the big house where all the railway Serbs lived, and I used to come across with brandy shrub. These three rooms were all one, and they held a big table on which the Serbs played every evening. But the Serbs are all dead now, and the railway runs, you say, nearly to Kabul.
Do you remember anything about the Serbs?
It is long ago, but I remember that one Serb, a fat man and always angry, was playing here one night, and he said to me, "Mangal Khan, brandy pani do," and I filled the glass, and he bent over the table to strike, and his head fell lower and lower till it hit the table, and his spectacles came off. And when we, the Serbs and I myself, ran to lift him, he was dead. I helped to carry him out. Ah, he was a strong Serb, but he is dead. And I, old Mangal Khan, am still living by your favour.
That was more than enough. I had my ghost, a first-hand authenticated article. I would write to the Society for Psychical Research. I would paralyse the Empire with the news. But I would first of all put 80 miles of assessed cropland between myself and that dark bungalow before nightfall. The Society might send their regular agent to investigate later on. I went into my own room and prepared to pack after noting down the facts of the case. As I smoked, I heard the game begin again, with a miss in balk this time, for the whir was a short one. The door was open and I could see into the room. Click! Click! That was a cannon. I entered the room without fear, for there was sunlight within and a fresh breeze without. The unseen game was going on at a tremendous rate. And well it might, when a restless little rat was running to and fro inside the dingy ceiling cloth, and a piece of loose window sash was making 50 breaks off the window bolt as it shook in the breeze. Impossible to mistake the sound of billiard balls. Impossible to mistake the whir of a ball over the slate. But I was to be excused. Even when I shut my enlightened eyes, the sound was marvellously like that of a fast game. Entered angrily the faithful partner of my sorrows, Kadir Baksh.
"This bungalow is very bad and low-caste. No wonder the presence was disturbed and is speckled. Three sets of dooley-bearers came to the bungalow late last night when I was sleeping outside, and said that it was their custom to rest in the rooms set apart for the English people. What honour has the Khansama? They tried to enter, but I told them to go. No wonder if these Uriyas have been here that the presence is sorely spotted. It is shame and the work of a dirty man."
Kadir Baksh did not say that he had taken from each gang 2 annas for rent in advance, and then, beyond my earshot, had beaten them with the big green umbrella, whose use I could never before divine. But Kadir Baksh has no notions of morality. There was an interview with the Khansama, but as he promptly lost his head, wrath gave way to pity, and pity led to a long conversation, in the course of which he put the fat engineer Saab's tragic death in 3 separate stations, 2 of them 50 miles away. The 3rd shift was to Calcutta, and there the Saab died while driving a dog-cart. If I had encouraged him, the Khansama would have wandered all through Bengal with his corpse. I did not go away as soon as I intended. I stayed for the night, while the wind and the rat and the sash and the window-bolt played a ding-dong 150 up. Then the wind ran out, and the billiard stopped, and I felt that I had ruined my 1 genuine hallmarked ghost story. Had I only stopped at the proper time, I could have made anything out of it. That was the bitterest thought of all.
As Rudyard Kipling said, "Words are, of course, the most powerful drug used by mankind." Think it through with us on audiobookradio.net.
Now we hear the dark humour of Saki in Tobermory, read by Richard Mitchley, followed by Daniel Defoe's story entitled The Apparition of Mrs. Veal, read by Gisela Rowe.
Tobermory. It was a chill, rain-washed afternoon of a late August day, that indefinite season when partridges are still in security or cold storage and there is nothing to hunt,
unless one is bounded on the north by the Bristol Channel, in which case one may lawfully gallop after fat red stags. Lady Blemley's house party was not bounded on the north by the Bristol Channel. Hence, there was a full gathering of her guests round the tea table on this particular afternoon. And in spite of the blankness of the season and the triteness of the occasion, there was no trace in the company of that fatigued restlessness which means a dread of the pianola and a subdued hankering for auction bridge. The undisguised, open-mouthed attention of the entire party was fixed on the homely, negative personality of Mr. Cornelius Appin. Of all her guests, he was the one who had come to Lady Blemley with the vaguest reputation. Someone had said he was clever, and he had got his invitation in the moderate expectation on the part of his hostess that some portion at least of his cleverness would be contributed to the general entertainment. Until tea-time that day, she had been unable to discover in what direction, if any, his cleverness lay. He was neither a wit nor a croquet champion, a hypnotic force nor a begetter of amateur theatricals. Neither did his exterior suggest the sort of man in whom women are willing to pardon a generous measure of mental deficiency. He had subsided into mere Mr. Appin, and the Cornelius seemed a piece of transparent baptismal bluff. And now he was claiming to have launched on the world a discovery beside which the invention of gunpowder, of the printing press, and of steam locomotion were inconsiderable trifles. Science had made bewildering strides in many directions during recent decades, but this thing seemed to belong to the domain of miracle rather than to scientific achievement.
"And do you really ask us to believe," Sir Wilfrid was saying, "that you have discovered a means for instructing animals in the art of human speech, and that dear old Tobermory has proved your first successful pupil?"
"It is a problem at which I have worked for the last 17 years," said Mr. Appin, "but only during the last 8 or 9 months have I been rewarded with glimmerings of success. Of course, I have experimented with thousands of animals, but latterly only with cats, those wonderful creatures which have assimilated themselves so marvellously with our civilization, while retaining all their highly developed feral instincts. Here and there, among cats, one comes across an outstanding superior intellect, just as one does among the ruck of human beings. And when I made the acquaintance of Tobermory a week ago, I saw at once that I was in contact with a beyond cat of extraordinary intelligence. I had gone far along the road to success in recent experiments. With Tobermory, as you call him, I have reached the goal."
Mr. Appin concluded his remarkable statement in a voice which he chose to divest of a triumphant inflection. No one said rats, though Clovis's lips moved in a monosyllabic contortion which probably invoked those rodents of disbelief.
"And do you mean to say," asked Miss Resker, after a slight pause, "that you have taught Tobermory to say and understand easy sentences of one syllable?"
"My dear Miss Resker," said the wonder worker patiently, "one teaches little children and savages and backward adults in that piecemeal fashion. When one has once solved the problem of making a beginning with an animal of highly developed intelligence, one has no need of those halting methods. Tobermory can speak our language with perfect correctness."
This time Clovis very distinctly said, "Beyond rats." Sir Wilfrid was more polite, but equally sceptical.
"Hadn't we better have the cat in and judge for ourselves?" suggested Lady Blemley.
Sir Wilfrid went in search of the animal, and the company settled themselves down to the languid expectation of witnessing some more or less adroit drawing-room ventriloquism. In a minute, Sir Wilfrid was back in the room, his face white beneath its tan, and his eyes dilated with excitement.
"By gad, it's true!"
His agitation was unmistakably genuine, and his hearers started forward in a thrill of awakened interest. Collapsing into an armchair, he continued breathlessly,
"I found him dozing in the smoking room, and called out to him to come for his tea. He blinked at me in his usual way, and I said, 'Come on, Toby, don't keep us waiting.' And by gad, he drawled out in a most horribly natural voice that he'd come when he dashed well pleased. I nearly jumped out of my skin."
Appin had preached to absolutely incredulous hearers. Sir Wilfrid's statement carried instant conviction. A Babel-like chorus of startled exclamation arose, amid which the scientist sat mutely enjoying the first fruit of his stupendous discovery. In the midst of the clamour, Tobermory entered the room and made his way with velvet tread and studied unconcern across to the group seated round the tea-table. A sudden hush of awkwardness and constraint fell on the company. Somehow there seemed an element of embarrassment in addressing on equal terms a domestic cat of acknowledged dental ability.
"Will you have some milk, Tobermory?"
asked Lady Blemley in a rather strained voice.
"I don't mind if I do,"
was the response, couched in a tone of even indifference. A shiver of suppressed excitement went through the listeners, and Lady Blemley might be excused for pouring out the saucerful of milk rather unsteadily.
"I'm afraid I've spilt a good deal of it," she said apologetically. "After all, it's not my Axminster," was Tobermory's rejoinder.
Another silence fell on the group, and then Miss Resker, in her best district visitor manner, asked if the human language had been difficult to learn. Tobermory looked squarely at her for a moment, and then fixed his gaze serenely on the middle distance. It was obvious that boring questions lay outside his scheme of life.
"What do you think of human intelligence?" asked Mavis Pellington lamely.
"Of whose intelligence in particular?" asked Tobermory coldly.
"Oh, well, mine, for instance," said Mavis with a feeble laugh.
"You put me in an embarrassing position," said Tobermory,
whose tone and attitude certainly did not suggest a shred of embarrassment.
"When your inclusion in this house party was suggested, Sir Wilfrid protested that you were the most brainless woman of his acquaintance, and that there was a wide distinction between hospitality and the care of the feeble-minded. Lady Blemley replied that your lack of brain power was the precise quality which had earned you your invitation, as you were the only person she could think of who might be idiotic enough to buy their old car. You know, the one they call the Envy of Sisyphus, because it goes quite nicely uphill if you push it."
Lady Blemley's protestations would have had greater effect if she had not casually suggested to Mavis only that morning that the car in question would be just the thing for her down at her Devonshire home. Major Barfield plunged in heavily to effect a diversion.
"How about your carryings on with the tortoiseshell puss up at the stables, eh?"
The moment he had said it, everyone realized the blunder.
"One does not usually discuss these matters in public," said Tobermory frigidly. "From a slight observation of your ways since you've been in this house, I should imagine you'd find it inconvenient if I were to shift the conversation onto your own little affairs."
The panic which ensued was not confined to the Major.
"Would you like to go and see if cook has got your dinner ready?" suggested Lady Blemley hurriedly,
affecting to ignore the fact that it wanted at least 2 hours to Tobermory's dinner time.
"Thanks," said Tobermory. "Not quite so soon after my tea. I don't want to die of indigestion."
"Cats have 9 lives, you know," said Sir Wilfrid heartily.
"Possibly," answered Tobermory, "but only 1 liver.
"Adelaide," said Mrs. Cornett, "do you mean to encourage that cat to go out and gossip about us in the servants' hall?"
The panic had indeed become general. A narrow ornamental balustrade ran in front of most of the bedroom windows at the Towers, and it was recalled with dismay that this had formed a favourite promenade for Tobermory at all hours, whence he could watch the pigeons and heaven knew what else besides. If he intended to become reminiscent in his present outspoken strain, the effect would become something more than disconcerting. Mrs. Cornett, who spent much time at her toilet table, and whose complexion was reputed to be of a nomadic though punctual disposition, looked as ill at ease as the Major. Miss Scrawen, who wrote fiercely sensuous poetry and led a blameless life, merely displayed irritation. If you are methodical and virtuous in private, you don't necessarily want everyone to know it. Bertie Van Tahn, who was so depraved at 17 that he had long ago given up trying to be any worse, turned a dull shade of gardenia white. But he did not commit the error of dashing out of the room like Odo Finsbury, a young gentleman who was understood to be reading for the church, and who was possibly disturbed at the thought of scandals he might hear concerning other people. Clovis had the presence of mind to maintain a composed exterior. Privately, he was calculating how long it would take to procure a box of fancy mice through the agency of the Exchange and Mart as a species of hush money. Even in a delicate situation like the present, Agnes Resker could not endure to remain too long in the background.
"Why did I ever come down here?" she asked dramatically.
Tobermory immediately accepted the opening.
"Judging by what you said to Miss Cornet on the croquet lawn yesterday, you were out for food. You described the Blemleys as the dullest people to stay with that you knew, but said they were clever enough to employ a first-rate cook. Otherwise, they'd find it difficult to get anyone to come down a second time."
"There's not a word of truth in it. I appeal to Mrs. Cornet," exclaimed the discomfited Agnes.
"Mrs. Cornet repeated your remark afterwards to Bertie Van Tahn," continued Tobermory, "and said, 'That woman is a regular hunger marcher. She'd go anywhere for 4 square meals a day.' And Bertie Van Tahn said..."
At this point, the chronicle mercifully ceased. Tobermory had caught a glimpse of the big yellow Tom from the rectory working his way through the shrubbery towards the stable wing. In a flash, he had vanished through the open French window. With the disappearance of his too brilliant pupil, Cornelius Appin found himself beset by a hurricane of bitter upbraiding, anxious inquiry, and frightened entreaty. The responsibility for the situation lay with him, and he must prevent matters from becoming worse. Could Tobermory impart his dangerous gift to other cats? Was the first question he had to answer. It was possible, he replied, that he might have initiated his intimate friend the stable puss into his new accomplishment, but it was unlikely that his teaching could have taken a wider range as yet. "Then," said Mrs. Cornet, "Tobermory may be a valuable cat and a great pet, but I'm sure you'll agree, Adelaide, that both he and the stable cat must be done away with without delay."
"You don't suppose I've enjoyed the last quarter of an hour, do you?" said Lady Blemley bitterly. "My husband and I are very fond of Tobermory. At least we were before this horrible accomplishment was infused into him. But now, of course, the only thing is to have him destroyed as soon as possible."
"We can put some strychnine in the scraps he always gets at dinner time," said Sir Wilfrid, "and I will go and drown the stable cat myself. The coachman will be very sore at losing his pet, but I'll say a very catching form of mange has broken out in both cats, and we're afraid of its spreading to the kennels."
But my great discovery," expostulated Mr. Appin. "After all my years of research and experiment..."
"You can go and experiment on the shorthorns at the farm, who are under proper control," said Mrs. Cornet, "or the elephants at the zoological gardens. They're said to be highly intelligent, and they have this recommendation that they don't come creeping about our bedrooms and under chairs and so forth."
An archangel ecstatically proclaiming the millennium, and then finding that it clashed unpardonably with Henley and would have to be indefinitely postponed, could hardly have felt more crestfallen than Cornelius Appin at the reception of his wonderful achievement. Public opinion, however, was against him. In fact, had the general voice been consulted on the subject, it is probable that a strong minority voice would have been in favour of including him in the strychnine diet. Defective train arrangements and a nervous desire to see matters brought to a finish prevented an immediate dispersal of the party, but dinner that evening was not a social success. Sir Wilfrid had had a rather trying time with the stable cat and subsequently with the coachman. Agnes Resker ostentatiously limited her repast to a morsel of dry toast, which she bit as though it were a personal enemy, while Mavis Pellington maintained a vindictive silence throughout the meal. Lady Blemley kept up a flow of what she hoped was conversation, but her attention was fixed on the doorway. A plateful of carefully dosed fish scraps was in readiness on the sideboard, but sweets and savoury and dessert went their way, and no Tobermory appeared either in the dining room or the kitchen. The sepulchral dinner was cheerful compared with the subsequent vigil in the smoking room. Eating and drinking had at least supplied a distraction and cloak to the prevailing embarrassment. Bridge was out of the question in the general tension of nerves and tempers, and after Odo Finsbury had given a lugubrious rendering of Melisande in the Wood to a frigid audience, music was tacitly avoided. At 11, the servants went to bed, announcing that the small window in the pantry had been left open as usual for Tobermory's private use. The guests read steadily through the current batch of magazines, and fell back gradually on the Badminton Library and bound volumes of Punch. Lady Blemley made periodic visits to the pantry, returning each time with an expression of listless depression which forestalled questioning. At 2 o'clock, Clovis broke the dominating silence.
"He won't turn up tonight. He's probably in the local newspaper office at the present moment, dictating the first instalment of his reminiscences. Lady What's-her-name's book won't be in it. It'll be the event of the day."
Having made this contribution to the general cheerfulness, Clovis went to bed. At long intervals, the various members of the house party followed his example. The servants, taking round the early tea, made a uniform announcement in reply to a uniform question. Tobermory had not returned. Breakfast was, if anything, a more unpleasant function than dinner had been. But before its conclusion, the situation was relieved. Tobermory's corpse was brought in from the shrubbery, where a gardener had just discovered it. From the bites on his throat and the yellow fur which coated his claws, it was evident that he had fallen in unequal combat with Big Tom from the rectory. By midday, most of the guests had quitted the Towers, and after lunch, Lady Blemley had sufficiently recovered her spirits to write an extremely nasty letter to the rectory about the loss of her valuable pet. Tobermory had been Appin's one successful pupil, and he was destined to have no successor. A few weeks later, an elephant in the Dresden Zoological Garden, which had shown no previous signs of irritability, broke loose and killed an Englishman who had apparently been teasing it. The victim's name was variously reported in the papers as Oppin and Eppelin, but his front name was faithfully rendered Cornelius.
If he was trying German irregular verbs on the poor beast, said Clovis, he deserved all he got.
As George Orwell says in 1984, if thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. Stay pure with audiobookradio.net.
The Apparition of Mrs. Veal by Daniel Defoe. This thing is so rare in all its circumstances, and on so good authority, that my reading and conversation have not given me anything like it. It is fit to gratify the most ingenious and serious inquirer. Mrs. Bargrave is the person to whom Mrs. Veal appeared after her death. She is my intimate friend, and I can avouch for her reputation for these 15 or 16 years on my own knowledge, and I can confirm the good character she had from her youth to the time of my acquaintance. Though since this relation, she is calumniated by some people that are friends to the brother of Mrs. Veal who appeared, who think the relation of this appearance to be a reflection, and endeavour what they can to blast Mrs. Bargrave's reputation, and to laugh the story out of countenance. But by the circumstances thereof, and the cheerful disposition of Mrs. Bargrave, notwithstanding the ill usage of a very wicked husband, there is not yet the least sign of dejection in her face, nor did I ever hear her let fall a desponding or murmuring expression, nay, not when actually under her husband's barbarity, which I have been a witness to, and several other persons of undoubted reputation. Now you must know Mrs. Veal was a maiden gentlewoman of about 30 years of age, and for some years past had been troubled with fits, which were perceived coming on her by her going off from her discourse very abruptly to some impertinence. She was maintained by an only brother and kept his house in Dover. She was a very pious woman and her brother a very sober man to all appearance. But now he does all he can to null and quash the story. Mrs. Veal was intimately acquainted with Mrs. Bargrave from her childhood. Mrs. Veal's circumstances were then mean. Her father did not take care of his children as he ought, so that they were exposed to hardships. And Mrs. Bargrave in those days had as unkind a father, though she wanted neither for food nor clothing, while Mrs. Veal wanted for both, insomuch that she would often say, "Mrs. Bargrave, you are not only the best, but the only friend I have in the world, and no circumstance of life shall ever dissolve my friendship." They would often condole each other's adverse fortunes and read together Drelincourt, Upon Death, and other good books, and so, like two Christian friends, they comforted each other under their sorrow. some time after Mr. Veal's friends got him a place in the custom house at Dover, which occasioned Mrs. Veal, by little and little, to fall off from her intimacy with Mrs. Bargrave, though there was never any such thing as a quarrel. But an indifference he came on by degrees, till at last Mrs. Bargrave had not seen her in 2 years and a half, though above a 12-month of the time Mrs. Bargrave had been absent from Dover, and this last half-year has been in Canterbury about 2 months of the time, dwelling in a house of her own. In this house, on the 8th of September, 1705, she was sitting alone in the forenoon, thinking over her unfortunate life and arguing herself into a due resignation to Providence, though her condition seemed hard. "And," said she, "I have been provided for hitherto, and doubt not but I shall be still, and am well satisfied that my affliction shall end when it is most fit for me." And then took up her sewing work, which she had no sooner done, but she hears a knocking at the door. She went to see who was there, and this proved to be Mrs. Veal, her old friend, who was in a riding habit. At that moment of time, the clock struck 12 at noon. "Madam," says Mrs. Bargrave, "I am surprised to see you. You have been so long a stranger." But told her she was glad to see her, and offered to salute her, which Mrs. Veal complied with, till their lips almost touched, and then Mrs. Veal drew her hand across her own eyes, and said, "I am not very well," and so waved it. She told Mrs. Bargrave she was going on a journey, and had a great mind to see her first. "But," said Mrs. Bargrave, "how can you take a journey alone? I am amazed at it, because I know you have a fond brother." "Oh," says Mrs. Veal, "I gave my brother the slip and came away because I had so great a desire to see you before I took my journey." So Mrs. Bargrave went in with her into another room within the first, and Mrs. Veal sat her down in an elbow chair in which Mrs. Bargrave was sitting when she heard Mrs. Veal knock. "Then," says Mrs. Veal, "my dear friend, I am come to renew our old friendship again, and beg your pardon for my breach of it, and if you can forgive me, you are the best of women." "Oh," says Mrs. Bargrave, "do not mention such a thing. I have not had an uneasy thought about it." "What did you think of me?" says Mrs. Veal. Says Mrs. Bargrave, "I thought you were like the rest of the world, and that prosperity had made you forget yourself and me." Then Mrs. Veal reminded Mrs. Bargrave of the many friendly offices she did in her former days, and much of the conversation they had with each other in the times of their adversity. What books they read, and what comfort in particular they received from Drelincourt's Book of Death, which was the best, she said, on the subject ever wrote. She also mentioned Dr. Sherlock and 2 Dutch books, which were translated, wrote upon death, and several others. But Drelincourt, she said, had the clearest notions of death and of the future state of any who had handled that subject. Then she asked Mrs. Bargrave whether she had Drelincourt. She said, "Yes," says Mrs. Veal. "Fetch it." And so Mrs. Bargrave goes upstairs and brings it down. Says Mrs. Veal, "Dear Mrs. Bargrave, if the eyes of our faith were as open as the eyes of our body, we should see numbers of angels about us as our God. The notions we have of heaven now are nothing like what it is, as Drelincourt says. Therefore be comforted under your afflictions, and believe that the Almighty has a particular regard to you, and that your afflictions are marks of God's favour. And when they have done the business they are sent for, they shall be removed from you. And believe me, my dear friend, believe what I say to you. 1 minute of future happiness will infinitely reward you for all your sufferings, for I can never believe," and claps her hands upon her knees with great earnestness, which indeed ran through most of her discourse, "that ever God will suffer you to spend all your days in this afflicted state. But be assured that your afflictions shall leave you, or you them in a short time." She spake in that pathetical and heavenly manner that Mrs. Bargrave wept several times. She was so deeply affected with it. Then Mrs. Veal mentioned Dr. Kendrick's ascetic, at the end of which he gives an account of the lives of the primitive Christians. Their pattern she recommended to our intimation, and said, "Their conversation was not like this of our age, for now," says she, "there is nothing but vain, frothy discourse, which is far different from theirs. Theirs was to edification, and to build one another up in faith, so that they were not as we are, nor are we as they were. But," said she, "we ought to do as they did. There was a hearty friendship among them, but where it is now to be found?" Says Mrs. Bargrave, "It is hard indeed to find a true friend in these days." Says Mrs. Veal, "Mr. Norris has a fine copy of verse called Friendship in Perfection, which I wonderfully admire. Have you seen the book?" says Mrs. Veal. "No," says Mrs. Bargrave, "but I have the verses of my own writing out." "Have you?" says Mrs. Veal. "Then fetch them," which she did from above stairs, and offered them to Mrs. Veal to read, who refused and waved the thing, saying, "Holding down my head would make it ache," and then desiring Mrs. Bargrave to read them to her, which she did. As they were admiring friendship, Mrs. Veal said, "Dear Mrs. Bargrave, I shall love you for ever. In these verses there is twice used the word elation." "Ah," said Mrs. Veal, "these poets have such names for heaven." She would often draw her hand across her own eyes and say, "Mrs. Bargrave, do not you think I am mightily impaired by my fits?" "No," says Mrs. Bargrave, "I think you look as well as ever I knew you." After this discourse, which the apparition put in much finer words than Mrs. Bargrave said she could pretend to, and as much more than she can remember, for it cannot be thought that an hour and three quarters' conversation could all be retained, though the main of it she thinks she does, she said to Mrs. Bargrave she would have her write a letter to her brother and tell him she would have him give rings to such and such, and that there was a purse of gold in her cabinet, and that she would have two broad pieces given to her cousin Watson. Talking at this rate, Mrs. Bargrave thought that a fit was coming upon her, and so placed herself on a chair just before her knees, to keep her from falling to the ground if her fit should occasion it. For the elbow chair, she thought, would keep her from falling on either side. And to divert Mrs. Veal, as she thought took hold of her gown sleeve several times, and commended it, Mrs. Veal told her it was a scoured silk, and newly made up. But for all this, Mrs. Veal persisted in her request, and told Mrs. Bargrave she must not deny her, and she would have her tell her brother all their conversation when she had the opportunity. "Dear Mrs. Veal," says Mrs. Bargrave, "this seems so impertinent that I cannot tell how to comply with it. And what a mortifying story will our conversation be to a young gentleman." "Why," says Mrs. Bargrave, "it is much better, methinks, to do it yourself." "No," says Mrs. Veal, "though it seems impertinent to you now, you will see more reasons for it hereafter." Mrs. Bargrave, then, to satisfy her importunity, was going to fetch a pen and ink, but Mrs. Veal said, "Let it alone now, but do it when I am gone, but you must be sure to do it," which was one of the last things she enjoined her at parting, and so she promised her. Then Mrs. Veal asked for Mrs. Bargrave's daughter. She said she was not at home. "But if you have a mind to see her," says Mrs. Bargrave, "I'll send for her." "Do," says Mrs. Veal, on which she left her, and went to a neighbour's to see her, and by the time Mrs. Bargrave was returning, Mrs. Veal was got without the door in the street, in the face of the Beast Market on a Saturday, which is market day, and stood ready to part as soon as Mrs. Bargrave came to her. She asked her why she was in such haste. She said she must be going, though perhaps she might not go her journey till Monday, and told Mrs. Bargrave she hoped she should see her again at her cousin Watson's before she went whither she was going. Then she said she would take her leave of her, and walked from Mrs. Bargrave in her view, till a turning interrupted the sight of her, which was 3/4 after 1 in the afternoon. Mrs. Veal died the 7th of September at 12 o'clock at noon of her fits, and had not above 4 hours' senses before her death, in which time she received the sacrament. The next day after Mrs. Veal's appearance, being Sunday, Mrs. Bargrave was mightily indisposed with a cold and sore throat that she could not go out that day. But on Monday morning she sends a person to Captain Watson's to know if Mrs. Veal was there. They wondered at Mrs. Bargrave's inquiry and sent her word she was not there, nor was expected. At this answer, Mrs. Bargrave told the maid she had certainly mistook the name or made some blunder, and though she was ill, she put on her hood and went herself to see Captain Watson's, though she knew none of the family, to see if Mrs. Veal was there or not. They said they wondered at her asking, but that she had not been in town. They were sure if she had, she would have been there. Says Mrs. Bargrave, "I am sure she was with me on Saturday almost 2 hours." They said it was impossible, for they must have seen her if she had. In comes Captain Watson while they were in dispute, and said that Mrs. Veal was certainly dead, and the escutcheons were making. This strangely surprised Mrs. Bargrave, when she sent to the person immediately who had the care of them, and found it true. Then she related the whole story to Captain Watson's family, and what gown she had on, and how striped, and that Mrs. Veal told her that it was scoured. Then Mrs. Watson cried out, "You have seen her indeed, for none knew but Mrs. Veal and myself that the gown was scoured." And Mrs. Watson owned that she described the gown exactly, "for," said she, "I helped her to make it up." This Mrs. Watson blazed all about the town and avouched the demonstration of truth of Mrs. Bargrave seeing Mrs. Veal's apparition. And Captain Watson carried 2 gentlemen immediately to Mrs. Bargrave's house to hear the relation from her own mouth. And when it spread so fast that gentlemen and persons of quality, the judicious and sceptical part of the world, flocked in upon her, it at last became such a task that she was forced to go out of the way, for they were in general extremely satisfied of the truth of the thing, and plainly saw that Mrs. Bargrave was no hypochondriac, for she always appears with such a cheerful air and pleasing mien that she has gained the favour and esteem of all the gentry, and it is thought a great favour if they can but get the relation from her own mouth. I should have told you before that Mrs. Veal told Mrs. Bargrave that her sister and brother-in-law were just come down from London to see her. Says Mrs. Bargrave, "How came you to order matters so strangely?" "It could not be helped," said Mrs. Veal. And her brother and sister did come to see her and entered the town of Dover just as Mrs. Veal was expiring. Mrs. Bargrave asked her whether she would drink some tea. Says Mrs. Veal, "I do not care if I do, but I'll warrant you this mad fellow," meaning Mrs. Bargrave's husband, "has broke all your trinkets." "But," says Mrs. Bargrave, "I'll get something to drink in for all that." But Mrs. Veal waved it and said, "It is no matter, let it alone," and so it passed. At the time I sat with Mrs. Bargrave, which was some hours, she recollected fresh sayings of Mrs. Veal, and one material thing more she told Mrs. Bargrave, that old Mr. Breton allowed Mrs. Veal £10 a year, which was a secret and unknown to Mrs. Bargrave till Mrs. Veal told her. Mrs. Bargrave never varies in her story, which puzzles those who doubt of the truth or are unwilling to believe it. A servant in the neighbour's yard adjoining to Mrs. Bargrave's house heard her talking to somebody an hour of the time Mrs. Veal was with her. Mrs. Bargrave went out to her next neighbour's the very moment she parted with Mrs. Veal, and told her what ravishing conversation she had had with an old friend, and told the whole of it. Delincourt's Book of Death is, since this happened, brought up strangely, and it is to be observed that notwithstanding all the trouble and fatigue Mrs. Bargrave has undergone upon this account, she never took the value of a farthing, nor suffered her daughter to take anything of anybody, and therefore can have no interest in telling the story. But Mr. Veal does what he can to stifle the matter, and said he would see Mrs. Bargrave, but yet it is certain matter of fact that he has been at Captain Watson's since the death of his sister, and yet never went near Mrs. Bargrave. And some of his friends report her to be a liar, and that she knew of Mr. Breton's £10 a year. But the person who pretends to say so has the reputation to be a notorious liar among persons whom I know to be of undoubted credit. Now Mr. Veal is more of a gentleman than to say she lies, but says a bad husband has crazed her. But she needs only present herself, and it will effectually confute that pretense. Mr. Veal says he asked his sister on her deathbed whether she had a mind to dispose of anything, and she said no. Now the things which Mrs. Veal's apparition would have disposed of were so trifling, and nothing of justice aimed at in the disposal, that the design of it appears to me to be only in order to make Mrs. Bargrave satisfy the world of the reality thereof as to what she had seen and heard, and to secure her reputation among the reasonable and understanding part of mankind. And then again Mr. Veal owns that there was a purse of gold, but it was not found in her cabinet, but in a comb box. This looks improbable, for that Mrs. Watson owned that Mrs. Veal was so very careful of the key of her cabinet that she would trust nobody with it, and if so, no doubt she would not trust her gold out of it. And Mrs. Veal's often drawing her hands over her eyes and asking Mrs. Bargrave whether her fits had not impaired her, looks to me as if she did it on purpose to remind Mrs. Bargrave of her fits, to prepare her not to think it strange that she should put her upon writing to her brother, to dispose of rings and gold, which looks so much like a dying person's request. And it took accordingly with Mrs. Bargrave, as the effect of her fits coming upon her, and was one of the many instances of her wonderful love to her and care of her, that she should not be affrighted, which indeed appears in her whole management, particularly in her coming to her in the daytime, waving the salutation, and when she was alone, and then the manner of her parting to prevent a second attempt to salute her. Now why Mr. Veal should think this relation a reflection, as it plain he does, by his endeavouring to stifle it, I cannot imagine. Because the generality believe her to be a good spirit, her discourse was so heavenly. Her two great errands were to comfort Mrs. Bargrave in her affliction, and to ask her forgiveness for her breach of friendship, and with a pious discourse to encourage her. So that, after all, to suppose that Mrs. Bargrave could hatch such an invention as this, from Friday noon to Saturday noon, supposing that she knew of Mrs. Veal's death the very first moment, without jumbling circumstances, and without any interest, too, she must be more witty, fortunate, and wicked, too, than any indifferent person, I dare say, will allow. I asked Mrs. Bargrave several times if she was sure she felt the gown. She answered modestly, "If my senses be to be relied on, I am sure of it." I asked her if she heard a sound when she clapped her hand upon her knee. She said she did not remember she did, but said she appeared to be as much of substance as I did who talked with her. "And I may," said she, "be as soon persuaded that your apparition is talking to me now as that I did not really see her, for I was under no manner of fear and received her as a friend and parted with her as such. I would not," says she, "give one farthing to make anyone believe it. I have no interest in it. Nothing but trouble is entailed upon me for a long time. For aught I know, and had it not come to light by accident, it would never have been made public. But now she says she will make her own private use of it, and keep herself out of the way as much as she can. And so she has done since. She says she had a gentleman who came 30 miles to her to hear the relation, and that she had told it to a roomful of people at the time. Several particular gentlemen have had the story from Mrs. Bargrave's own mouth. This thing has very much affected me, and I am as well satisfied as I am of the best grounded matter of fact. And why we should dispute matter of fact, because we cannot solve things of which we can have no certain or demonstrative notions, seems strange to me. Mrs. Bargrave's authority and sincerity alone would have been undoubted in any other case.